Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall, and this is the Downtime Podcast, where we take you inside the world of mountain biking, meet the characters involved, hear their stories, and find some insight to help us all get faster on our bikes. This week's episode is supported by Stylin Cycles, and their main man, Joe McEwen, is going to be joining us for a chat. Before we do that, just a few quick things. Don't forget to visit our website, downtimepodcast.com, for all your podcast needs. The show notes for all the episodes with links to the things that we've mentioned in the show, so you can find those nice and easily. There's a whole page to help you subscribe to the podcast, so you'll get each episode delivered to your device for free as soon as it's available. And you can join our mailing list there, which will keep you up to date with everything podcast related. And there's also links to all our social media channels, so you can keep involved in what's going on between the episodes. If you want to help support the podcast or just want something a bit different, then head to our web store, where we now have hoodies, sweatshirts, t-shirts and mugs available. The merchandise is all top quality and the proceeds go towards helping improve the podcast, bringing you more in-depth content. If you bought something already, then thank you. It means a lot. I really enjoy seeing the photos of you wearing it and using it, so keep those coming in. And it also looks like there's quite a few Christmas orders in there, so some of you lucky lot will be getting Downtime merch coming your way for Christmas. Right, it's time for this week's guest, and we're going to be joined by Joe McEwen of Stylin Cycles. Joe is an engineer like me who's left his day job to follow his passion. We talk about Joe's background in aerospace engineering, how he started Stylin Cycles, why a carbon fibre expert is now making steel bikes, his thoughts on some hot topics like bike weight and 29ers, and we chat a bit about his design philosophy and why it works. Joe also tells us about some new prototypes that he's working on, so you heard it here first. As a special treat for Downtime listeners, if you've been longing after a Stylin for a while, then now's the time, as Joe will throw in a free Stylin Cycles t-shirt. All you need to do is use the code DOWNTIME at the checkout. So head to stylincycles.com and have a look at what Joe's got to offer. The code DOWNTIME is valid until the 1st of January 2019, so don't hang about. Right then, let's get into this. Without further ado, here's Joe McEwen. Joe McEwen, welcome to the Downtime Podcast. How's things?
Yeah, all good. Yeah, hello everyone.
Good stuff. So let's talk a little bit about your background before we start talking about Stylin Cycles.
Okay.
You're an engineer by trade, I think, similar to me. Is that right?
Yeah. So yeah, went to university, did engineering degree at Bristol University, and then spent nearly 20 years in the aerospace industry as a stress engineer, sort of designing and analyzing bits of aircraft, mostly carbon fiber. Actually spent a lot of time in carbon fiber research, developing new technologies. Okay. I'm an engineer by trade, but also as a kid I've always made things, I've always pulled things apart, so it was always something that was going to happen. I've always been a fiddler, a tinkerer, that sort of stuff. So yeah, I was always going to be an engineer.
Awesome. And were you always into bikes? Was that something that came at a young age as well? Or
Kind of. I live where I grew up. I grew up in a little village, Woburn Sands, people probably know, because there's a whole set of dirt jumps there now.
Yeah.
And I grew up in the next village, Aspie Guys, and I lived opposite a bit of woodland. So my whole childhood was spent in the woods, and a lot of that was just bobbing around on bikes in the woods. And it wasn't mountain biking. It was just riding my BMX or riding my, I had like a road bike I used to ride around the woods. And my mates had the ones, the rally choppers and stuff. So it was just whatever bikes we had, and we bombed around the woods. And then I think got to about 15 and I actually started skateboarding, probably earlier than that, 14, 15. So I spent probably 5 or 6 years skateboarding and not so much biking. And then I spent about 10 years playing golf. So I was a very avid golfer. So the bike sort of took a back seat until, so I think second year of university, I'd probably drank too much and sort of my blood hadn't been going around very well. So I decided it was time to do something to get my blood moving. So I bought myself it was an orange P7 actually. That was the only time I've ever bought a full bike, and bought that in my second year of university with my student loan.
I was going to say student loan purchase.
Yeah. And used to bomb around Bristol Woods with a few mates and stuff, and that was kind of the start of it. And it took me a year of being sick because I was so unfit, and then just got into it more and more. And so I've always ridden bikes, But I've not really been a mountain biker until sort of halfway through university, really.
Okay, fair play. And when did engineering and mountain biking meet then for you?
I suppose I've always been a tinkerer with bikes as well. And I think I started it when I had a Santa Cruz Bullet.
Yeah.
And I wanted to try running more travel on it. So I bought myself a longer stroke shock, and I actually sort of made a new shock mount that bolted onto the existing shock mount that allowed you to run a longer stroke shock.
Right.
And whether it made the bike any better, I don't know, but it was, you know, it was good to fiddle with it. And then after that, I actually ran my downhill bikes as single speed for a long time. And there was a lot of tinkering involved there, building tensioners and building different chain guides and lots of kind of fiddling with things like that. And then really the sort of frame building part of it came, I think, you know, I had a bit of, I was sort of stress engineer, I was a contractor, you earn pretty good money. And I realized I could do a frame building course. And I thought, right, I've got the money to do this. So I put my name down. It's something I've always wanted to do. So I did a week's residential course with Dave Yates, who is I suppose he was a famous frame builder, 80s, 90s.
Built the donkey's knob, if I remember right.
And was his, no, his wasn't the dog bollocks or dog's bollocks. That was Chas Roberts.
That was Chas Roberts, yeah.
Yeah. So I went and did a week's course with him. So I camped for a week, and there was just two of us on the course, and made a little single speed hardtail. And it was really good. He was although I think technically he's not the best frame builder, he's such a sort of enthusiastic bloke. And he just sort of gave you the, you know, just the enthusiasm to do it. And he's like, just do it, you know, pick up your file and just do it. Just get on with making it. And I think people are scared of kind of cutting metal if you've never done it before. And he was very good at getting, you know, just making you confident to get on with it, really, and cut it. And so I made a bike there, brought that back home. And one thing he wasn't very good at was bike geometry. So he convinced me I needed a 71 degree head angle on my hardtail.
Pretty current.
I wasn't too convinced, but I kind of went with it because, you know, he was very insistent. And got it home, and it wasn't right. So I thought, right, I've got to change this head angle. So I made myself a jig out of, one of the key things here actually is, whilst I was waiting for the course, I had to wait about 18 months for the course. I actually moved to a new house. Mm-hmm. My new house had a big shed at the bottom of the garden. So the people who lived there before used it as a, it was their office. He was a happiness instructor or something like that. Happiness coach. And she was a cellist. And they had two separate halves and they did their thing in that. And there's kind of an insulated, double glazed office, really. And I ripped out all the interiors and turned it into a kind of workshop. And because I had this kind of workshop, I thought, well, I've now got a place to change this bike. So I made myself a little jig out of wood that just held the top tube and the down tube and allowed me to adjust the head angle, you know, got myself a head tube, got myself some oxyacetylene and a bit of brass and just chopped the head tube off and started again. And it worked. It was fine. So, you know, that was the first thing done at home.
Yeah.
And then I thought, right, okay, I can do that. Let's build a full bike. So I built a bike for my daughter. And so I thought,
nice.
You know, my brazing might not be that good at this stage, so I'll build something that it doesn't, you know, she's not going to put too much load through it. Doesn't need to be the best brazing. So I built a little kind of kiddie bike for my daughter, who was probably 3 or 4 at the time.
And
then that was it. Once you've done one, you then start, you know, start building more jigs, getting more equipment, got myself a lathe, and it's just sort of progressed from there, really.
Yeah, I was going to say, so how did that turn from tinkering in the shed to starting to think about starting a business and creating Starling Cycles?
So the business part of it was quite a long way down the line. That I built my daughter's bike. I then built a swing arm, and I had a Cannondale Profit swing arm, and I built a new front triangle for that. I then built a single speed full sus. and then started building enduro bikes. And I built about 7 or 8 bikes before, and I was kind of getting a design together. Yeah. And I gave one to, in fact, Dave Jackin, who was writing for Dirt at the time, came around, and I contacted Dirt and said, I'm building bikes in my shed. And I knew they were always interested in that kind of stuff. And they're relatively local up in Monmouth. So I contacted them and they said, yeah, we'll send Dave Jackin around to do a little feature. And Dave turned up and did a little feature on the shed and showed a couple of bikes. And then a few weeks later, I took one of the bikes to be ridden by Steve Jones. And Steve Jones rode one of the fairly early prototypes, I think number 7. And, you know, you said this is a really good bike, but it had some real issues with it. It was a bit overly flexy in the back. It had a rubbish shock on it. It was a bit too low bottom bracket. But it was really good to get his feedback because he's obviously a very good rider and a very good, you know, tester of bikes. He's ridden millions of bikes, so he's good at that. So I took on board his sort of ideas, went and built another bike, and then took that back to him. And that was the first one that he rode that he was, you know, he loved it. He thought it was amazing. But that was still a 27.5-inch bike. And I don't know if they ever wrote up that review on that bike. I think it got a few kind of social media posts. But then probably a year after that, I thought, right, I'm gonna build something really spangly to take to Dirt. And people were starting to show interest in buying them. So I made a swoop. I'd given it a name by that point. So the 27.5-inch bike, I got a really fancy paint job on it with the starling. So it was sort of black fading into pale blue with starlings flying across it. And it was absolutely beautiful, stunning, stunning bike. I managed to get some suspension out of Fox. That was nice. So, you know, really, really beautiful bike. Took that to show Steve Jones. And as I pulled that out of the van, he goes, what's that in the back of the van? And in the back of my van was the prototype 29er. And it was, I'd only just finished it. It had been finished, you know, like 2 days before. It was unpainted. It was going a bit rusty, you know. And he said, what's that one? I go, it's a 29. He goes, oh, I love 29ers. I'm riding that. And I go, well, what about my fantastic bike? I've spent a load of time making shiny for you. And you know, I want the 29er. So we went and did a loop of Forest of Dean, you know, rode a few trails in the Forest of Dean, and he absolutely loved it. And he said, right, you're not having that bike back. I want it for a few days. So he had that bike off me for a couple of weeks and, you know, loved it, rode it loads, did some timed runs. And I think that was kind of the defining point in styling cycles becoming a thing, was he did some timed runs on that prototype Murmur, and it was considerably quicker than a whole load of, you know, top end full carbon bikes with all the top notch kit on it. And my bike just had my crummy parts on it. So, and he posted that up on Instagram, and pretty much overnight I got quite a lot of orders for a bike that I'd only made a prototype.
Oh, wow.
And people ordered the swoop as well. And I'd actually sold a few swoops at that point. So I'd sold in the sort of year between the first Dirt article and this prototype, I'd sold about 6 or 7 of the swoops. So it just sort of, yeah, it just kind of happened, really. You know, people like the look of it. I seem to do something that interested people.
Yeah, yeah, it's amazing. And cool that Dirt was such a significant part of it. It's sort of sad to see it fade away.
Yeah, no, Steve Jones, you know, and he even I used to phone him up, and he used to say, hello, Styling Cycles marketing department. So he's kind of, he was well aware of what was going on, and that is, you know, he's very influential. He's people.
So how significant was that review of the Murmur then? Kind of how, you know, what was the change in volume of orders once that was out?
So before that, I think I had like 5 or 6 orders sitting waiting to be built. I'd built about 5 or 6 frames. I think pretty much overnight I got about, well, within the space of a week, I got about 20 or 30 orders. And
wow.
You know, I was still working full time as an aerospace engineer at this point. So I was kind of telling people, right, I can build it, but it's going to be a year's time at least before you get your bike. And people were pretty much happy to wait. You know, they sort of early adopters of things are quite often happy to wait, aren't they, and let it happen. So
yeah,
Yeah, so it was thinking, right, okay, this is something serious here. I was kind of lucky that my boss at work, I was contracting, I was doing a really deadly job signing off repairs for an aeroplane, I won't tell you which is broken. signing off repairs, it was really boring, basically calculations, big massive calculation files, checking and signing them off. Pretty deadly boring work. But it was a little bit, you know, sometimes there was lots of work, sometimes there wasn't. So when there wasn't work, my boss, who was also a mountain biker, was quite happy for me to go home and build bikes. So because I was earning good money, I was okay to sort of do 30 hours work and then spend 10 hours doing frame building during the week. Mm-hmm. So it worked quite well. And then the project I was working on was ramping down. Like we'd finished that phase of it. I kind of went to my boss, Steve, and said, right, if I, you know, I need more work. This project's running out. I need another chunk of work. And he said, you don't want to do this, do you? You want to build bikes. And I was like, oh, yeah, you're probably right. So that day I went home, went through my accounts. You know, I had a year's worth of trading and styling cycles. I'd sold 20 bikes, say. I'd worked out how much money I was making, what my costs were. I did a really detailed study of whether it could be a business. And pretty much concluded, if I can build 50 or 60 bikes a year, it will earn me enough money to sort of keep me, not as earning as much money as I was, but earning good money, or earning enough, essentially. So I went back and spoke to Steve and said, look, yeah, I think I'm going to give this biking a go. And obviously consulted my better half and, you know, thought about the family and stuff. I've got two young kids, so thought about that. And, you know, I worked about another 3 months doing gradually reducing hours. And then Christmas must be 2016. I went full-time at Styling Cycles.
Fantastic. So nearly 2 years now then.
Yeah. So it's, yeah, I did a year in the shed, working in my shed. And then in sort of January this year, I moved into the new workshop. So I've been 10 months in my new workshop. So it's nearly 2 years now.
Yeah. So do you have, is it still just you, or do you have more people under the Styling Cycles banner now?
There's no, I don't employ anybody, but I've got lots of kind of subcontractors that help me. So main person is, I've got a chap called Pi, who is, he's also a frame builder, and he's actually been helping me for quite a while making swing arms for me. So he makes the swing arms, but he's now in my workshop full time, and he does 3 days a week working for me, building swing arms, doing various other frame building jobs. And then he does 2 days a week with his own company called clandestine.cc. So have a look at that. And he makes custom stems, and he makes sort of touring bikes and a few other interesting things.
Cool.
And then there's a whole load of other kind of support people. I get my mitering. I actually subcontract that out to an engineering firm because I haven't got the equipment yet. So I send them a CAD drawing and they send me back all the miter tubes, and that helps with my sort of production.
So just for people that don't know, explain what mitering is.
Yeah, so two tubes. When you put two tubes together, you've got to cut one of them to a curved shape so it butts up nicely. And obviously different geometry bikes have slightly different mitered angles and stuff. And generally use a hole saw or a kind of a belt sander running on the right size mandrel. So there's different ways of doing it. And that's something I will bring in-house, but at the moment it's much better using this subcontract firm. I've got my powder coater, who's a chap, Warren, at RPA Powder Coaters. He does a fantastic job. I've got somebody, a designer, John Lambert, who runs his own graphic design company, Breathe Brandworks, he's called. And he's done all my graphics and my logos. And he's now actually helping me out with my merchandising. So he's going to run that as a separate business. And we've done some T-shirts as far as we've got, but we're going to try and do some more of that. And I have Jamie from Wide Open, who runs Wide Open. I actually pay him to do my social media. So he, you know, I give him content, but he runs my social media and posts stuff up. And so there's quite a lot of people. It's me. Styling Cycles is me, But then there's a lot of people that help me out, that I paid to help me out and just keep things running smoothly. And
yeah, great stuff. So what are the upsides of being your own boss then, since you've gone full time on it?
It's good. I probably work more though. Well, I work significantly more now running this than I did before. But yeah, you're just flexible. Like last week, Tuesday, me and Pi and one of my customers, Rob, went riding in Pontypool. Thursday, I had a customer come and visit and we went for a ride and he tested out a bike. I've got young kids, so I've walked them into school this morning. I've got a few days, but I've got to pick them up at the end of the week. And, you know, everything's easy, really. But you running your own business, you work flat out. So although it's flexible, I'm quite often sat doing emails till 10 o'clock at night every day, you know, just to get the emails out of the way. And there's, you know, you can't let things slip. If you go on holiday, things build up and you've got a backlog. So you have to work flat out after holiday to catch up. And so it's great being flexible, but it's hard work running a business. It's really hard work.
So, yeah. What sort of hours would you say you're putting in then, more than you were in a full-time job?
Yeah. So aerospace, I was working 40 hours a week. I'm now doing, I must be doing 60, 70 at least.
Yeah. You know, but more enjoyable.
Yeah, and it's really interesting. Yeah, I get to talk to people like you. And it's quite interesting, isn't it? And you know, nobody cares. Yeah. Nobody cares about what you've done in an aerospace job. They just want to know about the result. Whereas, you know, people are quite interested in the whole story of what's happened. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's great. Have there been any downsides to it, or any kind of really, really tough parts of doing your own thing?
No, because I'm quite sensible about it that, you make mistakes, things don't go right, but I always treat that as a learning experience and make it better. I don't really beat myself up about it. I'm quite pragmatic at, you know, if something isn't working, you sort it out, you find a way to sort it out. So there's nothing that's got me down about it. I can't, you know, I'm happy doing it. And even having to work the hours, I'm very good at, you know, making sure I don't get a backlog of emails, I don't get a backlog of accounting, all those things that can drag you down, I sort out and get out of the way so that you're always fresh. You know, I've got a to-do list, but I try and make sure that to-do list is always as short as possible and I've knocked over as many things as possible. And it's just a good way of not getting stressed by it and, you know, enjoy the enjoyable bits and just accept there's certain things you've just got to get on with.
Yeah. Cool. Makes sense. So let's talk a little bit about material choice then, I guess. So you're a carbon fiber expert in your old day job, and you now run a steel bike company.
Yeah.
Talk us through that a little bit and why you've decided to steer away from the carbon fiber side of things.
So I think kind of two things. The first one is really to build a carbon fiber bike in your shed is... People will say it's easy, but the ones you see coming out of sheds, they've had no external tooling. So they always look a bit rough. They just look like a sort of hand wrapped fiberglass thing. So the ones coming out of sheds aren't very professional. So if you want to start making a sort of professional quality carbon bike or looks professional quality, you start needing to spend money on tooling, external tooling. And that's a lot of money. You know, you need to start going to a machinist, somebody with a sort of three-axis, five-axis machine. So you're talking thousands of pounds to get some quality tooling. So I'm just...
More than, I guess, we're into tens of thousands, I suppose.
That's just for somebody to make something in your house, something rough. If you're doing something commercial, it's, you know, 10, 20, 30,000 pounds. So... Yeah. Whereas steel, and especially when steel allows flexibility of design, I can change my designs really quickly. So when I was in the shed, there was just no point doing carbon fiber. I can do everything with steel. I can build what I want with steel. But the more I've gone through, and a lot of it comes from the carbon fiber that I've worked with in aerospace is the highest quality there is. And it's not quality for performance reasons, which I think people get confused about. It does have to be strong and light. But in aerospace, it has to be high quality for safety. So you've got to be able to prove that the thing you manufacture has, you know, I can't remember what A basis and B basis, the certain allowables, like 99% of the time it achieved 99% of the strength. And you've got to be able to guarantee this behavior. So if you have a carbon fiber structure, and carbon fiber very easily has defects in the manufacturing, so it has resin rich areas, it has sort of waves in the carbon fiber layup, it has bits that end up cured a bit thinner than they should be. All of these things degrade the performance. And if you can't guarantee that that degradation doesn't affect the safety of it, then you can't use it. So there's huge amounts of money in aerospace go into ensuring it's high quality, it's consistent, and you can guarantee the strength of it. So I've seen that kind of carbon fiber. And then you look at what the bike industry is producing, and it's, compared to that, it's absolutely shocking. It's horrendous. So I was given a pair of handlebars recently, and they looked great, and they looked good. Looking down the ends of them, they looked good. But I decided to chop them down to go on a bike I had. And once you chop down where they'd obviously shoved a tool in the end of the bars, past the end of that tool, the layup was appalling. Like, it was crinkles, like bits sticking out. Absolutely awful. And I've seen various big brands, big manufacturing brands, cut cross sections of their carbon fiber bikes and posted them out to the whole world to see. And it's awful, like waves in the lamina, all kinds of disgraceful things that in aerospace you know, it wouldn't go anywhere, it would be in the bin within 30 seconds. But I've got to be a bit careful here that in aerospace you've got to guarantee the safety. In biking, it's a much more sort of redundant structure. You know, if one bit of your bike breaks, you're pretty safe. Something else will take the load. And it doesn't need that safety that aerospace does. And it's strong enough. They just put more carbon fiber there. So, yeah. And when companies really put their money into getting the weight down, they can get really low weights with carbon fiber. But, you know, some of the road bikes are ridiculous, aren't they? But that starts costing huge amounts of money. So, you can do carbon fiber, and it probably can be a really good material, but it costs a lot of money. And I think 99% of what there is out there isn't like that. So it's
okay, and kind of prohibitive for people working on a smaller scale and lower budget.
Yeah,
I guess it
needs big money. And then the more. Yeah, so that put me off. I've seen goods. I don't think, but I would never be able to make a bike to that level of quality. And steel, I think, is so good. Steel is strong. It doesn't fatigue. So you haven't got the issues you get with aluminium. It's very, very tough. You can dent a steel bike and it doesn't matter. It's easy to work with, tubes are easy to work with. Difficult to machine, which is a big negative, but you can get around that with good design. And it builds a lively bike. It's got a nice, you know, all the things. Everyone who rides my bike says they feel lively, they feel nice. It's got a really nice feel to it. And because it's got small diameter tubes, it's silent. It hasn't got all the resonance you get from these big carbon box sections and aluminium box sections. So the only, if you're really pedantic, you say, oh, steel's a bit heavier. And it is. It can't be built into as light a structure as aluminium or carbon fiber. But I think we're quite quickly learning that doesn't matter. There's a lot of people riding e-bikes with the motors turned off, going faster than people on a £50 e-bike with the motor turned off is quicker than a £20 carbon bike. And that's pretty common with people now.
Talk us through that a little bit. Why do you think weight is not an issue? Because we've kind of spent, I don't know, since I got into mountain biking, which is a long time ago, decades being told that lighter and stiffer is better. And there's now quite a few people going the opposite, actually, and saying that heavier and a bit flexier is maybe better. Tell us a bit about why that is.
So I'll start the weight thing. I've got this little example. I've told millions of people. I'll tell it to you now. So you'll say your bike weighs 15 kilos. What's that? Just over 30 pounds. And say you as a rider weigh 85 kilos, which is like 12, 13 stone. So that's quite sort of average weight, people. The total for the system is 100 kilograms. So when you pedal your bike up the hill, what are you taking up the hill? Is it just you, or is it just the bike, sorry, or is it you and the bike?
So, yes, it's the whole package, right?
It's the whole system. So you're taking 100 kilograms up the hill. So I reckon a top-end carbon bike is probably 500 grams lighter than one of my steel bikes if you had all the same components on it. So 500 grams in 100 kilograms is 0.5%. So pedaling uphill makes 0.5% difference for half a kilo.
Yeah.
So it's not a big difference. It does matter if you're a sort of 7.5 stone road racer riding a 8 kilo, 7 kilo bike, and you ride in for 400 miles, then those small differences start to matter. So if you're top of your sport, elite, world level road racer or cross country racer, yeah, it probably starts to matter. But for 99% of us who just pedal up a hill chatting to our mates, it's negligible. Absolutely negligible, that 0.5%. So then when you turn around and you start bombing down the hill, a little bit of weight is a positive thing. The weight just makes the bike more stable. It means it doesn't get knocked around a bit. It helps with the unsprung to sprung ratio for the suspension. So your suspension behaves a little bit better. It's just, adds a bit more momentum to drag you through stuff. So generally a little bit of weight is positive. And there's various people, Chris Porter, I suppose, famously, and Orange are starting to do it now, adding weights to their bikes to get that stability. And the example I gave about the e-bikes, and everybody who's ridden an e-bike will tell you how they just stick to the ground, how the grip is unbelievable. So I think as time goes on, we are going to start adding more weight to the frames to get that downhill grip and get that downhill performance, and you lose a few percent going uphill.
So is the weight it's beneficial on the frame as a kind of sprung mass, and then less beneficial or detrimental when it's on, well, the wheels, for example?
It is, but I'm also starting to think a bit of wheel weight is a really positive thing. And I'll do a little an aside here about 29ers, because this kind of all ties into the same thing. I've spent a lot of time thinking about why 29ers, it's becoming pretty accepted that 29ers are a bit faster, they ride a bit better. And people give, the first bollocks answer they give is, oh, it's a bigger tyre, it's got a bigger contact patch. Absolute nonsense. The contact patch is only proportional to air pressure. So the air pressure, so pressure times area equals force upwards, which supports your weight. So a 2.8-inch tyre at 20 psi has got the same contact patch as a 2-inch tyre at 20 psi. So contact patch, bollocks. It's a slightly different shape, but it's negligible difference, so bollocks. People talk about big wheels accelerate slower. They don't, because they spin slower. So the actual amount of mass passing the ground is the same. So the energy in spinning is the same. So they don't accelerate slower. People talk about bigger rollover. And I've done a few sort of CAD images. And if you look at, say, a 50 mil bump, and you look at the angle that 50 mil bump hits a 29-inch tyre and the angle it hits a 27.5-inch tyre, and the angle difference is tiny. It's fractions of a degree. So it's not until you start getting up towards the axle, so sort of a 200 mil bump, that it matters. But at that point, it's no longer rollover. At that point, it's... there's a fucking very big lump in the way. Excuse my language. But yeah, so that's not rollover anymore. So there's no change in rollover. The only thing I've found a difference in is the gyroscopic forces. So if you spin your wheel and you hold it by the axle, it's quite hard to move it out of plane. It's got a tendency to stay straight. So because the 29er is, because that behavior is proportional to a squared term, the small difference in diameter is accentuated by this square term. So I can't remember the numbers, but I think 29 has got 15-20% more gyroscopic stability. And one day I need to actually do the numbers for this. I've researched it, and I've read a few other people that have done the numbers. I've never done it for myself. I need to confirm this, but you can kind of feel it. And when you ride a 29er, you have to put more effort into leaning it over, and then once you've leant it over, it kind of sits there and they drift well. So I think that is the behavior that makes 29ers better, is the gyroscopic stability. So as you're barreling through a pile of rocks, the tire's got less tendency to get kicked offline. So right. I think that's what's going on with 29ers. But then that applies to wheel weight as well. If you've got heavy wheel, it's going to be less likely to be kicked offline. It's got more gyroscopic stability. And you find that ride in a downhill bike. They just plow through rough stuff. They stick on the same line, whereas really lightweight wheels get kicked off. So we might find that heavy wheels are good. And I know there's an impact on your sprung to unsprung ratio. Maybe that gyroscopic behavior is, you know, so it's all kind of trade-offs in different behaviors. But I think our assumption that everything is light is wrong, absolutely fundamentally wrong. And it comes from historically riding road bikes up hills where it matters. But for riding a mountain bike down a rough hill, it doesn't matter. Other things, weight is probably more important. A bit of weight is probably a good thing.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense, yeah. So what is the design philosophy behind your bikes then, when you've obviously thought through all of this a lot? What's kind of key to you?
I think my only philosophy is to keep things simple, you know, and I'll do everything possible to keep things simple. So the actual structural design is simple. So a single pivot, you know, there's nothing complicated going on. I've got a bit of a thing that I think that when things are complex, it's because you're applying a sticking plaster to fix a problem. You know, it's a cheap way. You've got a design, you realize the design's got a problem, and then you design away that problem with a fix to it. And in doing that, you add some complexity to it. Whereas the proper answer is to go back to the start and design it into the original design and keep it simple. So when you've got all these millions of acronyms and all these millions of things, it's because they keep thinking, oh, it doesn't pedal very well. We'll add such and such a blah, blah, blah to solve that pedaling. And then, oh, right, it doesn't have brake jack. Let's add a floating caliper and a blah, blah, blah. So you can end up with all these things bolted on that solve all these problems. But then you end up with a really inelegant design. So, and it's lazy, isn't it? It's like computer programs. Like, we've got these massively powerful computers running really inefficient software. And if they designed everything properly, everything we'd need computers for 20 years ago. We don't need them as powerful as they are. And simple design is good design. Complex design is lazy, in my opinion. So that's sort of my first thing. Keep it simple. So we have single pivot. That's nice and simple. I tend to go for a linear leverage ratio. And again, that's sort of bucking the trend. Everyone thinks, oh, it's got to be progressive. It's got to ramp up. But chatting to, you know, suspension tuners, and I've chatted to Chris Porter a lot, I've chatted to Dave Garland in the early days when I had some stories off him, chatted to Jake up at Sprung Suspension, Pedal the Bike Away, and some people at TF Tunes. And they all say, if you give us a bike with a linear leverage ratio, we can make a shock that works. It doesn't have to do anything silly. Whereas if you have a bike that is soft at the start, then ramps up, they can't tune the suspension. They can't tune the shims to work properly. So,
okay.
Yeah, you know, keep it simple and then let the suspension tuners do their job. And I've got a story on my bike at the moment, and it's absolutely fantastic. And, you know, the general knowledge or general sort of consensus would be, oh, it's got a linear ratio, it's not going to work. But yes, it does. It works really well. You can tune it to work.
So, do you think that simplicity leads into people kind of being able to understand the bike and ride it well quickly? Like, is a simple design easier to learn to ride?
So that's kind of one more thing about a simple is the single pivot. But we have anti-squat behavior, which is essentially how the bike reacts to your weight shift. So as you accelerate, as you brake, as you lean forward and backwards, imagine you've got a kink in your suspension. Then as you move, it'll affect the suspension. So I design my bikes to be as simple, as close to neutral as possible through the full suspension movement. So you've got a bike which is simple single pivot. It's a linear suspension curve, so it doesn't do anything silly. The anti-squat is simple. So the bike doesn't do anything silly. We did a demo day in the Forest of Dean last weekend, and quite a few people sort of came back and said, yeah, it's really, you know, it's just kind of neutral. It sounds really rubbish, but that's all I can think for. It just rides amazing. So it sounds really boring that you've designed a bike that's really neutral and doesn't do anything stupid. But we're humans. We have to ride this thing. And, you know, I'm kind of a great believer that a good rider can ride any bike. You know, Steve Peake could beat me on a shopping bike, and I'm sure he could quite easily. But if you gave him, you know, if you've got less to think about, you will be a better rider. You know, if the bike is doing less, you've got more brain capacity to deal with actually riding the bike, you will be a better rider. So,
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So what sort of rider would you say your bikes are best suited to? Is it, or is there
anyone really?
Is there a specific area? Right, okay.
They're not, I suppose if you're a big hucker and you're hucking to flat, then that is the time you do need a progressive leverage ratio, because you could design the shock to do it, but if you're jumping 10, 20 foot to flat, or you're riding bike parks and hitting massive jumps all the time, that's not necessarily the best. And also, you know, I'll talk about stiffness, but my bikes are a little bit more flexible than the standard bikes out there at the moment. So there's this belief that bikes need to be massively stiff for pedaling forces. And when you start railing berms and stuff, a little bit of stiffness helps in that aspect. So they're not necessarily park bikes. But then for riding natural terrain, you know, they're neutral. The stiffness, the flexibility in the chassis, that comes from the small diameter steel tubes rather than the material itself. It's because steel uses small diameter tubes. You get a bit of compliance. So that actually gives you grip. And the classic example, the one I give, if you lean your bike over 45 degrees, your bump is acting normal to the ground, vertical to the ground. So only half of the bump forces are going through the suspension. The other half mm-hmm. of the bump forces are bending the frame sideways. So if you've got a really, really stiff frame, then riding across your off camber, trying to grip on that, the frame is getting bounced out of the way and it can't stick to the ground. So you need a bit of compliance to let the bike stick to the ground and conform over when you're going around corners mostly and when you're riding off camber. So
okay, so your bikes generate more grip in those circumstances. Yeah.
And
cool. All right, good stuff. Oh, so I was just going to say, you obviously got to the point where the demand for your bikes is kind of more than one or two people can chip away at and keep welding bikes by hand. And I'm sure, you know, you have a pretty long waiting list for that kind of stuff. But you've looked at ways around that and solutions. And I think, am I right in thinking you're getting some bikes made out in the Far East?
Yeah.
Is that
right? So when we actually tied up with that dirt article, I got approached by an agent out in Taiwan to say, do you want to make some bikes? But at that point, I wasn't interested at all. You know, it wasn't the right time. I then spent a little bit of time chatting to a few kind of UK manufacturers. And we were talking about setting up a factory in the UK so we could do, for various brands, UK-made frames. But that kind of fell through in the end. And at that point, I thought I'd convince myself some bigger manufacturer would be a good idea at that point. So I actually went back and approached the agent in Taiwan, and we talked it through. And they seemed like good people, got some references for the agent, got some references for the factory, all looked sensible. So we started progressing the design. So really we turned my Murma frame, because that was the most popular, the 29er at the time, into something that was going to be produced in Taiwan. And it's fundamentally the same bike. It's just got a few machining detail changes, a few little, you know, slight changes, but really things that are improvements that are now rolling into my UK made frames. But it took 6 months to go from my initial rubbish 2D CAD drawings to the finished off, signed off CAD drawings. And a lot of it was, you know, tolerances, all the things that as a frame builder in a shed, you don't really think about. And when you're doing mass manufacturing, you've got to have signed off drawings. You've got to do so. It's just all the details, getting them right. And then I kind of pulled the trigger on, I had to get some tooling made. So it cost me a chunk of money to get some tooling made, to get some samples made. And then I went out to Taiwan to visit a factory and see them making the samples. And that was really valuable going out there, because I think their culture a lot relies on face-to-face contact and meeting people and shaking people's hands. And, you know, just and also seeing the factory. And the factory was amazing. It was, I think people have an image of either a sweatshop with kids in flip-flops and sort of no lighting and, you know, people with whips and all this awful, you know, like awful image. Or yeah. they think it's all robots making bikes and it's, you know, it's a proper like car production line. With, and this wasn't. It was it's a company called Aura who make a lot of other big brands, like Kotick, Stanton's, Production Privé. They make top-end commensals. They make a lot of stainless and titanium bikes. But they're... Really, it was like a big version of my workshop. It had, you know, machines to do certain jobs, but everybody in there was a trained frame builder. And they have, you know, people start off as apprentices, and there were people that had been there 40, 50 years doing frame building. And it's just that they do it on a bigger scale. But even then, they're only building batches of sort of 100 or 200 frames, as opposed to, you know, a giant factory that makes, you know, 10,000 of a particular frame. So it was... It was frame building, and it was fantastic to see. You know, they had, at one point they were putting the shock mount on, and they had a tool used to align the shock mount, and it was pretty much identical to what I have in my workshop. So it was just really odd seeing my bikes being made by somebody in Taiwan, but doing it in exactly the same way as I was doing it in my shed in Bristol at that point. And there was those bikes. We got some samples. We've ridden the samples for a year now, and they've been raced and got national champion racing one. Dan Bishop is Vets national champion. He's been riding that all year. And they turn up pretty soon, actually. Been a slight delay, but they'll be here in the next month. And that's a batch of 100 frames. And I've pre-sold quite a lot of them. I've got some going to a distributor in Australia. It's all looking good, really.
Yeah, that's awesome. And so that's going to make obviously the wait for people a little bit shorter, I suppose, if they're interested in
So the Taiwanese ones will be off the shelf once they're in stock. I'm doing custom colours, so they come in a grey kind of primer colour, and you can have that one off the shelf, or you can have a custom colour, and that's probably 2 weeks lead time. But then I'm still doing So the Taiwanese bikes are standard sizes. There's medium, large, extra large. And if people want a custom size, I'm still doing custom size bikes. The Swoop is still UK made for the time being, but I'm getting some Swoop samples made. But then all the other bikes I make, so the downhill bike, the Stern downhill bike, the Beady Little Eye single speed bike, the Migration, which looks like a city bike, they're all still going to be UK made. The demand, because the Murmur was the biggest seller, a lot of people have bought the factory one, and it's slightly cheaper, and it's actually sort of reduced the demand on the UK made stuff, which is really good. It's quite, if it continues as it is, it's quite a nice balance of sort of people buying Taiwanese and people buying UK stuff.
Yeah. So what's the weight like at the moment then on the UK built stuff?
The UK is actually pretty short. I think I've got 12 frames in the waiting list. I'm hoping to get them all delivered in time for Christmas of those 12.
Nice.
But I've got a couple of exciting prototypes I'm working on at the moment, and I imagine I'll get a bit of demand for those if they work out. So they'll probably need 6 months riding. And then, yeah, I think I'll get a bit of demand for those. So that should keep the UK build stuff going on.
Yeah. Anything you can tell us about, or is it all still top secret?
No, nothing's top secret. I'm doing a gearbox bike. So I've got one of my team riders and one of my customers are sort of helping me develop, or they're going to ride it, and they're sort of help fund it a little bit, a gearbox bike. So we're using an Effigear gearbox, which is a 9-speed from a French company, but it runs a trigger shifter. And it's one of the best things with it is that the output cog, where the cog that drives the chain, you can mount your swing arm concentric to that, which means you don't need any tensioners on the chain, where lots of companies are using pinions, and on the pinion you can't do that. So your pivot is located away from the output shaft.
So your chain length changes.
So you need some kind of tensioner. So we've got one of these Effigears. It looks like a nice thing. I've got the laser cut parts, so that's hopefully something I'll do in the next couple of weeks, start building up that prototype, and it'll be a 170mm travel 29er is the idea.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. 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 So a big destroyer.
Yeah. And then at the same time, I'm also going to build another bike, 170mm 29er, but high pivot. Essentially, it'll be the gearbox bike, but without a gearbox, running a mech. Partly to kind of do a comparison between the two, and partly I think some people are always going to be put off by a gearbox because there is a little bit of drag in it. We'll see how that plays out. I'm kind of interested to try a higher pivot bike as well, see how that works. That's something I'm trying to build. I'm also doing a clunker, teaming up with the Steel Is Real website. So Ben Mills runs a website, and it's gained a lot of sort of support recently. A lot of people interested in steel bikes, and I'm kind of chatting to him, and we're going to build a clunker. And it's really a one-off bike for Bespoke Show next year, but we've got a few kind of sort of industry partners giving us bits. We're going to give it a spangly paint job, and hopefully we're going to try and set up a race, a clunkers race.
Awesome.
So the idea being, people who ride clunkers seem a bit anal that it has to have a coaster brake, and to me that makes it really difficult for people to actually ride anything. Nobody has a brake with a bike with a coaster brake. So I think our idea is a rigid bike, only has a rear brake, and you have to have at least 800mm wide bars. So everybody can, and it has to be single speed. So I think everybody can build that bike up pretty easily from something they've got in the shed. Everyone's got a rubbish old mountain bike somewhere. And then we'll do a race, and there'll be, a fun race with lots of beer and a big campfire and, silly clothes and all this kind of stuff, and just try and turn it into a bit of an event.
Yeah, sounds good fun.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, good look out for that one. So where would you like to see Starling then in, let's say, 5 or 10 years down the line? Kind of what's the long-term vision for it?
I don't know. I suppose I'm not driven by money. I've got a nice house, got a nice family, live in a nice area, everything's pretty good. I don't want any shiny cars, anything like that. So yeah, it's never going to be to make huge amounts of money out of it. What I enjoy is doing the interest in engineering. So my ideal situation would be small batches of frames from Taiwan that almost sell themselves and, generate enough income that allows me to pay for my workshop and pay for my tools and pay to develop new bikes and then make small batches of the interesting bikes in the workshop in the UK. That'd be ideal, really.
Yeah. So really a passion project and something that keeps you engaged and interested.
Yeah. Yeah. And ideally get somebody in to deal with all the boring stuff would be good. But just keep it simple. Like the workshop I'm in is great. It's not massive, but it's a really nice location. It's south facing, so we get loads of sunlight in. It's just a really nice place to be. And if you can keep it like that, it'd be great.
Cool. And while we've got a fellow engineer on the podcast, the recent UCI changes free up different wheel sizes, front and rear. What are your thoughts? Is it something you've ever played with?
I built one for a customer quite early on, and it was a nightmare because just in the manufacturing, the way my jig is designed, the wheels are at the same axle height. So it just took a load of complicated CAD to work out how high the different axle heights were. And all. It was just a bit of a bugger to design. It's only because of the way my jig is set up.
Right.
But maybe. I don't know. I haven't tried it. But again, Chris Porter sold on it and he seems to get a few things right. So maybe. Big on the front, small on the rear. I kind of think wheel size is quite a lot to do with the size of the rider though. A taller rider suits 27.5 inch, a shorter rider suits smaller wheels, and really short riders probably want 26, kids want 24, 22, it's got to be an ergonomic fit. And it kind of goes back to what I was saying before, that if everything's neutral and everything's balanced and everything fits properly, and that's important, then you'll ride a bike well. You know, it's the rider is the dominant factor, not the bike. So make the bike work for the rider, and then everything else works. So yeah, different wheel sizes, that's interesting. But
yeah, do you think there's a cutoff like in height for 29er below which it gets a bit uncomfortable or doesn't really work ergonomically?
I kind of think below sort of 5'6", you're better on 27.5.
Okay.
Partly because it might just be to do with my bikes actually, that the Murmur has got a longer chainstay. It's got a 445 chainstay. So that chainstay suits the longer front triangles. It balances the bike out. Whereas my Swoop has got a 430 chainstay, and that suits the shorter front triangle. So to get the bike balanced, the smaller rider suits the smaller wheels and the bigger. But, you know, ideally I'd like to change chainstay lengths, but that's something I'm working on at some point in the future. You know, so I think if you're really tall, it'd be 6'6", you might even longer chainstay length to balance out the bike. And,
so different chainstay length for different frame sizes you're talking about.
Yeah.
So which is just a cost in the manufacturing, I guess.
Yeah, it is, yeah. And in with the Taiwanese stuff, it'll never happen. They won't entertain that kind of thing. But for me in the UK, it's just a jig change. It's a mitering jig change, and it's a swing arm jig change. And I haven't, my jigs are quite fixed in their sizing, and that's sort of the cheapest, best way to do it. But ultimately, I'll design a proper adjustable jig and do that.
Cool. Good stuff. Well, we're getting close to the end of our time today, but we've got three questions that we've asked most of our guests now. So we'll hit those up. First one, if our listeners had £150 to spend to improve their performance on a bike, what would you recommend they spend it on?
There's two things. Either lessons, you know, lessons are great, but everyone seems to say that, I think. So, and I've had a lesson with Sam Fowler up at Pedal Progression, and my race results have just improved dramatically. I'm a reasonable rider, but he suddenly made me a good rider.
What was the biggest thing you took away from that then? What was the biggest thing you've changed?
I think the way I rode was I lent the whole bike and lent myself over. So the way I went around corners was, and it was something I used to ride in, I lived in Spain for a bit and it was really rocky. And the way you got around those corners was you just leaned and then the bike followed you. And that's a good way of riding. But if you've got a series of corners, that doesn't work very well. It'd be better to move the bike underneath you. And I just never did that. And I always had problems in series of corners. So he kind of got me to sort that out and just get the weight balance a bit better. That was really good. But I think the other thing, if you want to buy a bit of kit with your 150 quid, get some tire inserts. And everybody who knows me knows I've been banging on about tire inserts for ages, and they are such a good thing. They're not just because of the puncture protection, but because of the tire pressures it lets you run. So I did a race at the weekend, and it was filthy mud. And I think I had probably 10 PSI in my front tire, and everybody else was all over the place. And I was sticking sections that people couldn't ride, and it was...
Yeah.
You know, and it also gives you damping in the tire as well. So we've got a 6 inches of travel with an inch of travel at the end that's undamped. So we spend £1,000 on a fork for your brilliant damping, and then you've got this undamped string at the bottom. And I think there's massive development in tire inserts that could go on to get. Now, so imagine you launch into a pile of rocks. The first thing your tire does when it hits the rock is bounce up before the suspension's had a chance to react. So if you had a tire that could absorb that and just stick to the ground, it makes huge differences on how a bike would ride.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. What tire inserts are you using?
I'm kind of using a mix of Mr. Wolf's and Krishkor, and they are the two best products. And I've tried a few. A lot of them are just foam that they sell as something good. The Mr. Wolf's is a foam, but it's a properly engineered foam, and it's got different densities. It's a quality product. And then the Krishkor is something that they, it's a properly engineered product. It's a little bit hard to fit, but it's, once it's in, it's fantastic. And it doesn't go all the way to the edge of the tire. So you still get the supple bit of the tire, but then it supports the sidewalls. It gives you the puncture protection, gives you a bit of damping. So it's,
yeah. Do you change between those based on where you're riding and the conditions, or do you have one in the front and one in the rear?
At the moment, I've got Chriscore front, Mr. Wolf's rear, and that seems to work well.
What's the theory behind choosing one in the front and one in the rear?
I think the Mr. Wolf's gives a bit more puncture protection because it feels more of the tyre. So if you do get a flat, you've got 10 PSI in your tyre. Whereas if you get a flat with the Chriscore, you've got something with zero and then a hard bit. But the Chriscore gives you that better compliance, and you can run lower pressures with the Chriscore to get the grip up front.
Yeah, interesting stuff. Cool. The next question: if you could wind back the clock and sit down with your 16-year-old self, what advice would you give him?
Nothing I'd want to say on here, probably.
Okay.
I don't want to answer that question.
Fair enough. And then the last one, if you could have coaching from anyone, past or present, who would it be and what would you want to learn from them?
Coaching. Oh, right. I don't know. I suppose Steve Pete is sort of a bit of a hero. He's done such good stuff for the sport, and he's such a good rider. And he seems like a nice bloke. I have a pint with him afterwards. So, yeah, probably Pete.
Yeah. And is there anything specific about his riding that you want to find out how he does? Or
He just looks good, doesn't he? He just hangs on and plows through and carries speed. I'm just not as big and strong as him, I suppose. But, I quite like his riding. He's not fancy, but you can see he's just motoring, isn't he? You wouldn't get in his way. He's carrying a lot of speed.
That is for sure.
Yeah, I don't know. I think more for the character than learning extra things, special things out of it, or learning stuff out.
Yeah, cool. All right, good stuff. Well, it's been really interesting chatting and finding out more about what you've been up to and how it's going. If people want to find out a little bit more, where's the best place for them to head?
I'd say my styling website, so www.stylingcycles.com, or I've got an Instagram account or a Facebook account. Or feel free to send me an email, and I reply to my emails pretty good. So, yeah, let me know. Or come and visit the workshop if you're in Bristol. Quite happy to have people into the workshop.
All right, great stuff. We'll put some links to websites and things like that in the show notes, and to some of the other stuff that we talked about as well, so people can find that. But, thanks a lot for your time. It's been super interesting, and look forward to seeing more stylings out on the trails.
Yeah, thank you, Chris. That's great. Thank you.
Awesome. Cheers.
Bye then.
Well, that's it for this week's episode. I hope you enjoyed listening. Don't forget, if you're interested in a Starling, then head to starlingcycles.com and use the code DOWNTIME to get yourself a free t-shirt to go with your shiny new bike. If you've got a couple of minutes, then please leave us a review on your favourite podcast app. It really helps people find the podcast, so it's a great way to help us out. Also, if you want to support the podcast, then you can head to our web store at downtimepodcast.com and grab yourself some top quality merch. Right, this is our last episode before Christmas, so I hope you all have a fantastic time, whatever you're doing. We've got an awesome episode coming up that will come out between Christmas and New Year. But until then, get out and ride.